crewmen instantly. As John fired along the ridgeline, his back was exposed to the concentration of fighters from Bunker 2 and the Dishka position. As the Rangers, PJs, and Gabe Brown began to pour out onto the snow from the helo's ramp, John was raked with fire from behind, several rounds connecting with his legs. Two entered his lower left leg, lacerating his left calf, and another embedded in his heel. His right leg was devastated. One round entered above the kneecap, exiting out the other side a few inches away. Two rounds slammed into his thigh, the first shattering his femur. His body jerked involuntarily with the impact. Though his body was mangled by small arms fire and shrapnel, John Chapman battled on, changing out to his last good magazine. The only other one he had on him had been shot through on his Rhodesian vest, rendering it useless. He fired at any target he could see along the ridge, unaware of the many enemies converging behind him, focused intently on his back. One of them, Chechen or Uzbek, took aim at the prone American now in the open and on the ground, an easy target at a handful of steps, and fired two rounds from his AK-47. John, quite literally firing the last of his ammunition at the enemy immediately in front of him, would have felt the bullets strike home. The tight two-round shot group entered his upper torso close together on their trajectory until connecting with his aorta, exploding the organ and dropping his blood pressure to zero. His ammunition and life expended. John Chapman died. The last images before his eyes closed forever were of blood-spattered rock and snow on a desolate mountain peak, while other men raged around him, fighting for their own lives. Chapter 22. March 4th, 06:13 hours. On his first approach to Taker Gar, Greg Calvert was concerned about what they were going to find on landing. Both pilots decided to make a pass to assess the situation before committing themselves and the men in back. During the high-speed pass over the pinnacle, I saw out the right window that there seemed to be several black spots that I said looked like explosive impacts. I also saw flashes from what I assumed was small arms fire coming from a large rock outcropping and tree at the very pinnacle. That passed off the right side, and we dove down over the cliff to regain speed. I did some jinking to make sure that we weren't too easy of a target. Razor 01, carrying the QRF, may or may not have been an easy target, but one thing was certain. Their landing was not going to be easy. We came up a draw on the back side of the mountain to stay as invisible as possible to the pinnacle. I picked out a landing area with the big rock and tree at the 2 o'clock position. Everything from here on out seemed to move in slow motion. On short final, at about 100 feet, I remember thinking, well, this is it, make it a good one, and put the aircraft in a decelerative attitude. As he looked out the cockpit, trying to judge his final approach, the whole cockpit seemed to erupt. Although I only heard the aircraft noises, holes started popping through the windscreen and side windows, but I continued the approach. I called out, taking fire from 2 o'clock, and heard Sergeant Phil Svitok's gun open up on the right side. I felt the breeze of rounds whizzing by me, and my head was nudged several times to the left. Also felt several hits to my chest, body armor. Then the situation turned, in the worst way possible for a helicopter pilot. The first RPG slammed into the right side of Razor 01, destroying the engine and sending burning shrapnel slicing through the rear of the fuselage. Calvert felt the aircraft shudder and nose pitch up and knew by the sound and feel that we lost an engine, although I didn't know which one. The aircraft was coming down. There was no longer any doubt. Calvert, drawing on over a decade of flying MH-47s, still managed a near-zero airspeed landing. Despite the steep angle of the mountain and lack of control, I felt we made a good but firm landing under the circumstances, but the aircraft did not feel stable, so I held the controls, knowing that the customers in the back would be offloading while Chuck, the co-pilot, reached up and pulled back the power control levels. That was my first realization that we would not take off again. Chuck reached over, slapped my arm, yelled, "I'm out of here," and disappeared out the left emergency exit. The cockpit was filling with smoke. Flames came out of the instrument and power distribution panels in front of Calvert. Outside, he could see three people firing at them from a large rock outcropping. Footnote. The outcropping seen by Calvert was the same rock that the 60-gunner SEAL tumbled off when he got shot in the leg, just next to Bunker 1, which Chapman, no doubt, had just vacated. The pilot grabbed his M4, charged the weapon, and began shooting through the window, while still holding the helicopter stable with his left hand on the cyclic. It was a remarkable display of calm and courage, especially given he was the only one left in the cockpit. When the helo seemed to finally settle and stabilize, he took his left hand off the cyclic, reached up, and tried to open the emergency exit, thinking, "I've never done this before." He managed to get it open, kicking the panel free, and it fell to the snow 4 feet below. Still firing his weapon one-handed, his left arm up in the air, I felt it slam away from me to the left. I don't know how long I sat there, but I can remember just sitting there staring at my hand. The glove had popped off, inside out, hanging on by just the tips of my fingers. It didn't hurt, and I can remember thinking that my hand looked like a lava lamp. Blood was squirting out of it. It had fallen over the side of my wrist, and it glowed. What Calvert didn't realize in his shock, the glowing object was actually a 762 tracer round, burning inside his hand. In the rear of the aircraft, Gabe was sitting in his seat, close to the cockpit and right behind Phil Spitak, the right door minigun gunner. He felt the aircraft shudder, and even over the whine of the engines and rotors, heard the RPG's detonation. He and Kerry made eye contact. Both of us thinking the same thing. "Here we go." The entire troop compartment rocked back and forth just as Svitok opened up at 6,000 rounds per minute, projecting a liquid stream of bullets that connected him to the enemy. The M134 made a loud vrrr sound for a second, then abruptly stopped. Gabe watched the aerial gunner slump over his weapon, shot dead from a machine gun burst that struck him in the chest. The carnage grew inside the helicopter as the stricken bird settled to the ground. Inside, a ranger, Specialist Mark Anderson, leader of a two-man M240 machine gun crew, shouted to his assistant gunner, "Today I feel like a ranger," amid the cacophony. His words had no sooner left his lips than he fell dead from rounds fired by unseen assailants, striking him through the paper-thin aircraft skin. As men ran off the back, two others, Sergeant Brad Crows and Corporal Matt Commons, fared no better. The two platoon mates dropped dead only steps from the open ramp, cut down by more machine gun fire. Gabe, now on his feet, was waiting his turn to get the hell out of the death trap. Things must be better outside. When Svitak absorbed the full blast of the machine gun, he probably saved the combat controller's life at the cost of his own. There wasn't time to reflect on luck. Gabe hadn't even stepped off the helicopter, and he had already seen three men fall. At that rate, all of them would be dead in the next 5 minutes, and he still had no idea where exactly he was. None of them had maps of the mountain or area, another CSAR curse. There were never maps of the target area, simply because the location was never known until after a crisis occurred. He waited to die or escape the helicopter as the men in front of him attempted to un-ass the destroyed helicopter. The time was 06:15. As soon as he stepped off the back, he saw Jason and Carrie working on casualties. They were doing PJ things, treating guys. As the controller stumbled into the snow, he found himself asking, "What do I need to do? How can I positively affect this?" He took cover at a rock as fire erupted all around him, snow dancing and dirt pitching into the air as rounds struck. Behind him, the helicopter took another RPG round, this time to the nose, but the blast and its concussive force carried all the way to the rear and to Gabe. He looked at his rock, which was only calf height, and took a knee. There was nothing else but snow. He shouted to the closest Rangers, "Who's the team leader?" It sounds odd, but you have to remember, I'd never met the guy, and everybody's wearing the same damn helmet. And it's chaos. I don't know who's dead. Gabe and Self shared a brief exchange amid the deafening fire as the Rangers were lighting up the hilltop. Above them, the enemy reoccupied Bunker 1. With John Chapman dead, the position opened up new opportunities to plunge fire down on the latest group of infidels to land on their mountain. Even with their own casualties mounting, it was hard to believe their good fortune of a third helicopter, no doubt delivered into their hands, all praise to Allah. And while this one had a larger fighting force, they had the numbers, the high ground, and superior firepower. With no place to hide and needing to orient himself, take stock of the terrain, and gain control of all the air assets that were surely coming his way, Gabe Brown single-handedly set about changing the enemy's advantages. His immediate call was on the gunship common frequency to the AC-130s he could still hear overhead. I got hold of Mike Bushy and also CCT Joel Hicks, each on different gunships, but both of them told me, "We have to go," and they left. So much for gunship support, but it wasn't their fault. Footnote. The gunships above Operation Anaconda have sometimes received criticism for their failure to deliver results or remain on station. This is best refuted by DJ Turner and his Grim 3-2 crew, who remained on station overhead as the dawn broke, completely against AC-130 protocol and despite direct orders to return to base. As they flew north toward K-2 airfield, headed for a severe ass-chewing from Colonel Mulholland, the Task Force Dagger commander, the entire crew agreed it was the right thing to remain into daylight until fuel forced them from the battle. Gabe and the QRF had arrived at a coincidentally unfortunate time. This mission was not going to be easy. So now I'm trying to coordinate and figure out what's going on. You have to deal with what you've got. Or not God, depending. One thing seemed obvious. He was not likely to survive in the open. He made a quick scan for better cover, looking to his left at the smoking wreckage of the helicopter, hit by yet another RPG, this one skipping across the tail ramp and down the mountain, confirming that was definitely not the place to go. In front of him, looking uphill, were Rangers and open space where he saw bodies strewn on the ground. To his right, two more Rangers were fighting furiously. He elected to stay put. The next crucial call, to get air support, would need to take place via satellite. He set about getting his SATCOM running, calmly erecting his satellite antenna, connecting it to his PRIC 117 radio, and immediately making comms with Champ 20, the TF-11 fire support call sign, whose job it was to obtain and push aircraft to the combat controller. Gabe's call sign was Slick 01, and Slick had just become the number one priority of America's entire war effort, holding the lives of everyone on the mountain in his handset. Aircraft were already being diverted to him by Champ. The first to arrive were F-15 Strike Eagles. Their presence wasn't going to be enough. Before he, or any CCT, called in airstrikes in a dynamic and chaotic crisis, he needed to ensure his air support did not hit any friendlies. It took precious minutes to determine there were SEALs nearby, the remainder of Mako 3-0, but not on top of the mountain. Satisfied striking the rock and bonsai tree above his position posed no threat to the closest friendlies, he started the lengthy process of talking on the pilots to his location. With Gabe and the Rangers so close, they weren't willing to drop bombs. Not yet. However, anything to keep the enemy suppressed would help, and possibly save lives immediately. But the F-15s had never done gun runs like this. Their cannons were designed for air-to-air engagements, and they had to start their runs from 20,000 feet using a much steeper than acceptable angle. They did it anyway. The pilots really stepped up their game. During my entire day and night of calling CAS, I only had to call 2 knock-it-offs, aborts. It was amazing, really. Back inside the helicopter, Calvert was looking out the side of his cockpit to the snow below, and suddenly decided that it didn't seem like such a good idea to drop onto the ground below on the same side as the enemy fire. He pushed into the rear after his flight gear got hung up on his seat. He hollered at the closest medic, the helicopter's own Corey Lamoureux. "I'm hit!" just as the RPG round Gabe had seen struck the nose. The medic's garbled response didn't make any sense until he very clearly heard him shout, "Take your fucking helmet off!" He tumbled into a heap near several others as he took off his helmet, and Corey began to work on him, applying a tourniquet to stem the blood loss. I remember thinking how big and purple my hand looked, and I was pissed because they had shot off the new watch my wife had sent me. Calvert looked at the spent tracer round protruding from his hand. I don't know why, but I pulled it out and put it in my sleeve pocket. He then watched Corey put an IV in his arm, followed by Jason trying to put an oximeter on his finger to measure the oxygen levels in his blood, only to find it wouldn't work. Frustrated, Jason discovered one of the wire leads had been severed by a bullet. The PJ tried to put a pressure sleeve on the IV bag to increase the fluid's flow rate, but discovered it, too, had been shot. Calvert remembers seeing Svitak and wondering why the 2 medics weren't working on him. He looked up at them and recalls, "We were still taking rounds through the aircraft, but Corey and Jason were still up and moving around. I told them to get the hell down, we can't afford to lose you guys." They eventually moved the pilot out of the aircraft, placing him alongside other wounded crewmen. Corey, Don, the 3rd pilot, and Jason would alternately work on us and fire back at the enemy that were now firing from the 6 o'clock of the aircraft, behind a large rock and what looked like a large bonsai tree. I wanted my M4 back, but somebody had already taken that. Meanwhile, Gabe was getting multiple aircraft support. I had F-15s, 16s, you name it. Then Jay comes up on the radio, which was helpful. The 2 controllers began shaping the battle together. From Gabe's position on the side of the hill, he couldn't get a good sense of the Al-Qaeda defenses above him, their numbers or locations of fighters. J-Team had a clear view looking at it from the north. And from their repeated exchanges, Gabe's challenges slowly came into sharper focus. As he gained confidence, he began to walk bombs onto the mountain. Bunker 1 continued to pour fire down on the QRF. One ranger had his SAW machine gun shot to pieces in his hands as others were struck down around him. The SEALs of Mako 3-0, while not on top of the mountain, remained missing for Gabe. Pinning down their location was critical because more enemy forces would most assuredly converge. Hoteling, 3,200 meters to the south, finally put eyes on the beleaguered remnants of Mako 3-0. Champ 2-0 also keyed in on this information and asked him to contact the SEALs. At 0745, Hoteling reported, "Negative contact with Mako. Jaguar, Hoteling, is south of their location. Bombs getting ready to drop in vicinity of Hilo in approximately 30 seconds. Hilo on top of hill. Fighter was talking to Slick, Gabe." From Hoteling's position, he and the Aussies continued trying to find the survivors of Mako 3-0. Finally, he spotted them and called Champ. "Jaguar reports they are south of the Hilo's location looking up the valley onto the western side of the ridge." With all friendly positions accounted for, the 3 combat controllers, Gabe, Jay, and Hoteling, began managing all the airstrikes and dominating airspace above the battle raging around Razor 01. To those unfamiliar with exchanges like those between the controllers, Champ 2-0, and the strike aircraft, they can appear confusing. Like air traffic controllers, each party uses abbreviated speech, acronyms, and sequencing to convey precise information. The following transmissions, come from the battle's official logs and take place over the span of 4 minutes. These are the only ones that were captured in the record. During the event, the volume of radio traffic was extreme and challenging for even an expert ear to decipher. AFO, Blaber. Aussie commander intends to push an element to the 1688 grid square. Watch the valley to the east, south of Marzak. They will be dropping bombs there. Champ. Trying to get Mako, 3-1, Andy Martin, down south to control the fire. J-Team said they have eyes on the location. AFO is going to push the bomber to J-Team. J. Roger, be advised. Friendlies are danger, danger close. Hotailing. Aussie's on channel, frequency, internal freak while moving. AFO. Need J-Team to work anything on the whale that comes up. J. Roger. Champ to Gabe. Slick 01, you've got a wildfire above you that is armed. You got 13 rangers at the base of the mountain. They are working their way up the hill. Have you linked up yet? Footnote. This was the second MH-47 with nothing but rangers, and the second part of the QRF. Diverted to Gardez until the situation stabilized or crystallized, it eventually landed at the base of Taker Gar and disgorged 13 more rangers. Also aboard was Vic, the SEAL who left the safe house and hopped on the helicopter to get to Mako 30 without informing Blaber or anyone else. This would have far-reaching implications as the battle wore on. Gabe to Champ. Negative. Have 4 dead, numerous wounded. Slick 01 going back to work the fighters. In order to alternate between fire direction frequencies and SATCOM, Gabe recalls, I was playing the antenna game, switching between SATCOM and UHF line of sight because I only had the 1-prick-117 radio. Every time I did, they thought I died because I kept going off the air. Hotailing to Champ and Gabe. Slick 01 was working F-15s, now out of bullets. 2x F-16s now in area. Is Slick good with comms with AC, aircraft? Gabe. Yes, F-15s are dead on with their bullets. Bullet runs only. From Jay's OP, where he was simultaneously dropping bombs on the whale and keeping an eye on his friend's precarious position, he saw Al-Qaeda fighters at the bonsai tree and told Gabe, Hey, they're still alive. I can see them moving behind that tree. I can see them. One guy, two. Gabe reported, Anybody up there? You got a guy with the high ground. All he has to do is roll over and pin any one of us trying to run uphill. Enter Wildfire, the CIA drone mentioned in the transmissions above. Gabe recalls, Wildfire showed up and he's selling me on this shot on Bunker 1. Realizing this shot is going to be no more than 50 meters from the closest rangers, Gabe discussed it with the team leader, trying to convince him that the bonsai tree was a good point of reference and was a known position, and the Wildfire pilot, who, unlike the fighters, had been circling and observing the battle for some time, knew what he was doing. Self, the Ranger team leader, is not about this shot, didn't want me to take it, but the Wildfire guy is insisting he can take it. A tense minute of consideration and calculation passes for the young combat controller, who is embroiled in his first gunfight with life-and-death airstrikes. Finally, I tell him, kill the fucking tree, but I'm thinking, holy shit, I hope this works out. Because of the danger close, back then we were way inside the danger range, I had to give him my initials to authorize it, cleared hot, golf bravo, and crossed my fingers. And he hit right in the bunker. And that's when we began our transition up the hill. At the rear of Razor 01, Jason was rotating among his growing number of patients. Calvert remembers, Jason was trying to start an IV in my neck but was unsuccessful. Corey, who was working another patient, said, We'll take care of that later. Calvert was beginning to feel the accumulated damage to his body. In addition to his arm, and the excruciating pain, he'd also absorbed several pieces of shrapnel from one of the RPG impacts. Lying in the snow, strapped to a litter, he faced his body armor toward the enemy and was anything but sure of the day's outcome. Dirt and snow continued to be kicked up on us from rounds. He passed out several times. When Corey bent over to check him once, I asked him that if I didn't make it, please tell my family we did a good job that day and that I love them very much. Cut that shit out. We're going to be off this mountain before you know it, replied the medic, who was glad the pilot continued to engage and remain aware. The time was 10:30, and Calvert remembered hearing and seeing the predator overhead. I could also hear fast movers, but never saw them. It was strangely comforting to hear and feel them strafe close to us. By then, Gabe was getting saturated by air support, which was a double-edged sword. In order to keep those higher in the command chain informed and reduce the number of times he was switching antennas, he resorted to using Jay Hill and Hotailing as his relays. He also wanted to get the worst of the casualties off the mountain and told Jay he believed he could get a medevac in safely. Probably an MH-60 would be best since their approaches and departures were accomplished significantly faster than the lumbering MH-47s. Jay to Blaber. Slick 01 has taken the hill but is taking ineffective mortar fire 200 meters east of his position. He feels it is safe to bring in a medevac at this time. Blaber. Advise him that ATF is firing mortars. In other words, it is friendly fire. Jay. Roger. Slick has linked up with QRF, the 13 Rangers from the 2nd Helo. Believes personnel 800 meters to the east are enemy. Once he gets medevac, he will direct strike aircraft onto location. Slick feels he can secure HLZ and requests ETA of medevac. AFO, backing the man on the ground, to Champ. AFO copied transmission. Hill secure, ineffective mortar fire to the east. Slick feels safe to bring in medevac, linked up with Chalk 2 PAX, the 2nd group of Rangers. J-Team advises Slick wants medevac to come in on top of hill beside crash site. Slick will vector aircraft in. In Bagram and Masara, where all the rank resided, they remained unsure of the ground situation and compounded their fundamental misunderstanding by relying on the predator feeds being pumped onto computer monitors through the two TF-11 JOCs. Trebon and his staff were not willing to commit another helicopter and crew to attempt the evacuation. This exchange, Gabe and Self asking for a medevac, and TF-11 denying or delaying the request, continued throughout the entire mission. As the day wore on, Gabe continued his onslaught while using Jay to relay information, occasionally handing planes off to or receiving them from Hotailing, who was bombing Al-Qaeda positions to the south. To Calvert, this very personal first-hand experience of close air support was new. As a helicopter pilot, he'd never been on the ground with troops before, and what he was experiencing for the first time was similar to everyone else on the hill. The danger-close aspects of Gabe's airstrikes were unlike anything seen by the men on the mountain, including the controller. Imagine standing on a point, then throwing a frisbee the distance an average adult can manage. Frisbee distance does not produce the standoff measurement one hopes to be from a 500-pound bomb when it explodes. Consider still that this lethal delivery is provided courtesy of a 28-year-old pilot flying a fighter jet at 500 miles per hour using a joystick. These considerations do not make being on the mountaintop, mere feet away from detonation, desirable, unless one has supreme faith in the pilot and the combat controller. We would hear Gabe yell, 30 seconds to impact, not knowing what that meant at first, but realized it when the first bomb hit. The whole world seemed to shake. It was like the earthquakes at Bagram. The city experienced a 7.4 magnitude quake the day before, killing 150 people across the torn country. But more violent. It seemed to me at the time that I could see the bombs coming in, screaming across the sky. I can remember saying to Chuck that I hoped these guys were good because the bombs seemed to go right across my vision and hitting close. He had no idea just how close the skilled CCT was cutting it until, I remember watching the rock and bonsai tree. When the bombs hit, I saw bodies flying and dirt and shrapnel fell around us. That felt good to me. After the noise subsided, I could hear screaming from behind the rocks. But Calvert and the men around him were not free from danger. Their hilltop redoubt was being assaulted from multiple directions. The summit had merely been one of the enemy pockets. Even with the addition of more Rangers, the possibility of being overrun remained a threat as the casualties continued to mount. Rounds were impacting all around Calvert and the others who lay prone at what had become the casualty collection point. There was no safe place to put the injured. We could actually see them firing at us. I yelled to Corey and Jason, who were up on their knees working on us still, to get down or get the hell out of there. The two trained lifesavers ignored him, and their constant exposure to enemy fire finally caught up with them a moment after Calvert shouted his warning. Both men were hit by the same burst of fire. I watched them both fall over, and when they didn't move, I thought they were dead. Eventually, Corey stirred and managed to check his own injuries. He'd been shot in the belly twice. "It felt like someone hit me as hard as they could with a sledgehammer," recalled the father of two, who, as he came around, felt it was manifestly unfair to his children that he was going to die on this mountain. Jason lay still, his injuries grave. As Corey checked him, he realized his fellow trauma expert was bleeding heavily internally. His pelvis was in pieces from the round that shattered it. It was now 11:30. The airstrikes continued throughout the day. From his new perch on the top of the mountain, Gabe found some company in the form of a dead Chechen. He was this little brown dude in a Rastafarian hat clutching his weapon crumpled up next to me, up to his knees in snow. I tilted his hat back and, holy shit, a perfect headshot from one of the Rangers. And so I spent the day with that guy. It was the best vantage spot I had. 12:17, Gabe to Champ. Currently working Scarface 1-1, two F-16s, but he is unable to drop JDAMs. He has to go refuel. Champ. Champ will go to Boss Man, AWACS circling overhead, and get more CAS. 13:10, Champ to Gabe. Do you have comms with any CAS, strike aircraft? Gabe, Roger, talking to Stone 3-1 at this time. Champ, be prepared to receive Snake 4-1, carrier-launched F-14s, after this. 13:30, Champ to Jaguar 1-2. J-Team just completed bombing run with B-1. Now, observing Eastern Ridge, need Jaguar to continue to push suppression on the south. Hotailing, Jaguar 1-2 copies all and will stand by this freak. 14:20, Gabe to Champ. Slick 01 advises total packs to exfil is 33, and that the two casualties that were on the HLZ prior, Roberts and Chapman, may be booby-trapped. 6 total patients. 5 litter, of those 2 urgent surgical, 3 priority, 1 routine. 6 KIA includes 2 found on LZ. Champ. Champ will pass info to hospital and medical so they will be ready. Let the boys know we are going to take care of them. We'll pass this off to the exfil rescue commander. They still haven't had authority to launch. Gabe. Slick would like to keep CAS coming to keep enemy off our backs. 14:40. Hotailing to Champ. Jaguar observed no scattering of troops. We'll continue to work southern targets and to the west. Champ. When we get to H hour, the extraction of Gabe, the Rangers, and casualties, we want you to go to Boss Man and get CAS and split it between you and Slick to help prep the area before the Apaches come in from the north and west. Suppress the ridge line and valley on their way in. Hotailing. Jaguar copies all. 14:56, Champ to Gabe. You are having the two ship of fighters being pushed to you. Right now, J-Team has them because they are receiving mortar fire. Gabe. Roger. 16:07, hotailing to Champ. Jaguar will take care of C2, command and control, tent, and truck location. Slick is too busy with troops in contact. Don't know if Slick has enemy contact, just that he is busy with Cass overhead. Need to confirm no friendly positions within 1.5 kilometers of target. Champ. Roger. 1758. J to Champ. J-Team wants a 400 by 1,000 meter box of bombs to be dropped vicinity Whiskey Bravo 177914 to get rid of some pesky mortars. Champ. Champ verifying no friendly packs in the box. As the day wore on, Gabe continued his attempts to convince TF-11 to send them a medevac to get the critically wounded out. By 1800, Captain Self also called Champ, stating, Kilo Alpha 16 Romeo, Self's call sign, requesting through Champ to bump up exfil time. If not, am sure two critical will die. Champ's consistent response. They are working it. Unfortunately, the golden hour, so-called because if a casualty is treated within the first 60 minutes, his chances of survival are more than doubled, had long since passed. Matt LaFrenz, the Ranger medic, was now treating Jason as best he could since Corey had lapsed into incapacitation. Calvert, himself in severe shock and shivering in the cold darkness that had enveloped them, watched and recalled, I can remember them working on Jason and then announcing he was dead. Heard the anger in Matt's voice telling Captain Self that we had lost another man. I can remember saying a prayer for Jason and his family. At 1814, Self got on the radio to Champ and confirmed all sensitive items, communications equipment, were zeroed on Razor 01, meaning it was now clean to be abandoned when the QRF and casualties were extracted, adding flatly at the end of his transmission, KIA numbers to 7. Jason Cunningham, the young PJ so focused on learning all he could to treat and save others, became the last man to die on Taker Gar. When the extraction helicopters finally began to arrive, the first landed at 2016. 2 hours after Cunningham had passed away. That first helo, another TF-160 MH-47, bore the wounded for their long flight to Germany and then home. Footnote. Corey Lamoureux survived to see his children. Greg Calvert kept his hand and, more remarkably, returned to full flight status and continued his career as a pilot. The second and last exfil helicopter arrived at 2027. Gabe handed Cass control over to Dave Smith, another CCT from the 2-4 who had flown in on the helicopter. I did a handshake with the 2-4 operator. I briefed him on, here's where we're taking fires. He asked me if I had any spare batteries. I just laughed. No. The second MH-47 carried the dead who'd been staged on the top of the mountain to await transportation, including Chapman and Roberts. Remembers Carrie Miller, we were concerned that the bodies might be booby-trapped, so the Rangers initially moved them with ropes. It took the PJ some time to discover one of the bodies was his 2-4 Green Team teammate, a shock to the veteran operator because we were told there was only one American on the mountain going in. And when we finally got on top, in addition to John, the enemy were also wearing some of Robert's American clothing. With the dead went the remainder of the original Rangers and Gabe. As he trudged up the ramp, exhausted, emotionally drained, yet still amped up, he remembers vividly, we had to climb over the dead bodies, stacked like wood in a weird way, which have a certain smell, and it's combined with the fuel smell of helicopters. I was sitting farthest to the rear. His brain was still on. I was mentally preparing myself. If we go down, I'm going to have to start this again. Preparing my equipment, ready to execute if we get shot down again. In my mind, it was a bit like being back at combat control school. Are we done yet? 10 time zones away, in Fayetteville, North Carolina, it's a mild and sunny March morning. The East Coast grass is already coming to life, introducing patches of green to its winter brown. Valerie Chapman has just dropped off 5-year-old Madison at kindergarten, having deposited her younger sister, Brianna, at preschool. She stops at the office, where she works as a nurse doing in-home care. At her desk, she dials the 24 and gets an admin person. They exchange pleasantries, and Val asks for John's new mailing address, because she has a package to mail him. With address in hand, she hops in her green family minivan and heads to her first appointment. By lunch, she's headed to a simple case short-term wound care, much easier than some of her other housebound patients. This one is the father of her supervisor. Val was assigned him because her boss knows she will do a good job. She sits on the couch and looks over the wound, nothing serious. In the background, he has his TV tuned to Fox News. They both see the ever-present breaking news banner at the bottom. This particular one announces 6 to 7 Special Forces soldiers were killed today in combat operations in Afghanistan's heaviest fighting to date. Valerie and her patient, a veteran, read the banner, but no other information comes from the talking head. She thinks, gosh, I feel bad for those Army families. A sad thing, they both agree. Her duties complete, she reverses the process, retrieving the girls from school, and heads home to make dinner. Chapter 23. March 4th. Late afternoon. Combat Controller Jeff George had just arrived in Bagram at the TF Blue JOC. He and his SEAL troop had finished conducting blocking point operations and were standing by as additional QRF in support of other operations underway in Kandahar, several hundred miles to the south. The missions weren't particularly fruitful, and the men had returned to base looking for more work. As he rolled into the SEAL Operations Center on March 4th, it was clear something big was going down. Outside, Captain Kernan, the SEAL Team 6 commander, was on an Iridium satellite phone talking with Vic, who was by then on the lower slopes of Taker Gar with Slab and the other surviving members of Mako 3-0. You could see the stress he was under in his face and posture. He was clearly out of his element, but trying to make sound decisions. The guy was maxed out, Jeff recalls. Inside was charged pandemonium. Brigadier General Trebone was technically in charge, but the TF Blue TOC was wholly a SEAL Team 6 affair. It was the general's presence that made it a higher headquarters, TF 11, but the SEALs were running the show. Jeff and his teammates were put on notice for the possibility of being the QRF to the QRF on Taker Gar. He recalls, "We're waiting for word that we're going to go, or for the situation to sort itself out." As the day went on, information began to trickle in. Then word comes that there's casualties and some KIAs, but we're not going anywhere. He wandered in and out of the TF Blue TOC as day turned to dusk and then into evening. Meanwhile, we're waiting for helos to bring the guys back. Finally, word came that the first helo was inbound. Jeff was helping with the transloading of wounded when the second helicopter landed carrying Gabe and the bodies of those killed in action. The deceased were collected by some of the 24 and 23rd STS PJs in Bagram for forward movement to Germany and then Dover Air Force Base, Delaware, where all KIA U.S. service members are received and prepped before being released to their families. Ross, one of the SEALs and a friend of Jeff's from Mobility Troop, approached the 27-year-old controller and cut right to the heart of the matter. "Sorry, man. Chappie's one of the guys. I was the first Air Force guy to learn," he recalls of hearing about his friend and fellow 24 CCT. Shortly afterward, the Rangers were looking for someone from the 24. Jeff was the only one nearby when one asked him, "Who's taking care of this?" The Ranger was holding a green aviator's kit bag, the ubiquitous military 2-foot-square canvas carry-all, which held all of Chapman's gear. Everything had been stripped from his body by medical personnel, with the exception of his uniform. Jeff took the kit bag and headed toward the 2-4 hooch area, where John's cot and personal items remained, just as he'd left them 48 hours before. Unlike most operators' living areas, Chapman's, a cot with a low row of unfinished wood shelves and a small card table for a nightstand slash desk, was neatly arranged. On the stand were several pictures of Madison and Brianna. Inside the bag, Jeff looked at the final artifacts of the controller's life. His weapon, which had absorbed multiple rounds, was junked. His Rhodesian vest was shredded, clear signs of struggle, and was covered in blood. Inside the vest was a full magazine, useless. It had been shot through by one of the AK rounds that killed or wounded his friend. He set the bag down with the rest of his friend's belongings, and, with nothing more to do, left the muddied and bloodied vestiges of John Chapman, the photos of his daughters standing sentinel over them. At home in North Carolina, Valerie and John's tiny sentinels are settling in for the evening on March 5th. Outside, she checks her mailbox and encounters her neighbors, Laverne and Roger. They were this older couple, a sort of mom and pop we were very close to, and Laverne said, "You have this different aura about you." And I'm thinking, okay, not sure what that means. But I didn't feel anything was different. Infinitely practical and not prone to superstition, she bids farewell and sets about her evening. The nearly complete family has an ordinary dinner, and by 9 p.m. the girls are in bed when the doorbell rings. Both of them, excited by the distraction and the possibility of putting sleep off a bit, rush to the door, shouting, "Who's that?" "Daddy's friends," calls their mother, stepping in from another room. But Valerie can see blue uniforms through the sidelight window, and she knows what's coming. "Go back to bed, girls," she tells them, and the two scamper off in knee-length nightgowns, trailing blonde and brown curls. At the door, she braces herself, opens it, and steps outside so the girls won't hear. On the doorstep stood Lieutenant Colonel Ken Rodriguez, the 2-4 commander, Master Sergeant Kenny Longfritz, the unit's first sergeant, whose job is the welfare of and assistance to unit members and their families, and an Air Force chaplain. "Please tell me he's just hurt badly," she implores. But Rodriguez shakes his head and asks if they can come inside. Valerie tells them to wait on the porch while she calls the neighbor to have them collect the girls first. They stand uncomfortably over the prolonging of their grim task. When the girls had been spirited away, the three men step inside and everyone sits down. Without preamble, Rodriguez speaks the words every wife dreads. "Valerie, I'm sorry. John's been killed in combat." This is not the Air Force-approved script, which is explicit in its delivery and simplicity. But on the way to the house, Rodriguez had been hit by a realization that directed how he would proceed. This news was going to change the lives of all three girls irrevocably, and the process, starting with the news, was about helping Val and the girls as best I can, if at all. The last thing I was going to do was deliver some bureaucratic bullshit. Sitting on her couch, leaning toward Rodriguez and looking directly at him, she asks, "What happened? I want to know." She knows his answer will avow that life as she knows it is over. Forever. Rodriguez, a deeply religious and emotional man, said, "I'll tell you everything I know, including classified information. What I know so far is John's actions were very selfless and likely saved the lives of members of his team," and went on to recount what he knew at the time, which wasn't everything. Not yet. Valerie, alone in her home with three messengers of death, absorbs the information and asks a few more questions as they wait for another member of the 2-4 to arrive. Alex Johns was John's friend and fellow controller and would serve as Valerie's family liaison officer, whose job was to see to the widow's needs throughout the repatriation, funeral, and subsequent memorials. Alex would virtually live with Valerie and the girls for the next few weeks, only going home for the occasional shower and change of clothes. Before Rodriguez and Longfritz depart, the commander asks, "Is it okay if we pray together?" The compassionate gesture is completely outside notification protocol, but in that moment, and without reservation, Rodriguez felt it was exactly what to do. His instincts proved correct when the two of them, one burdened with immense loss, the other with the obligation to deliver the message, dropped to their knees in prayer. In that moment, Valerie and Rodriguez, two people, relative strangers bonded by death, began an unlikely and lifelong friendship. Back in Bagram, Gabe Brown arrived at the 23rd STS area on a different part of the former Soviet airbase from the 2-4 and TF Blue forces. His first thought was to place a call to his wife, Gloria. It was a quick call. I told her I was in a series of bad situations that were significant events for me, but that I was okay, he recalls with understatement. His deployed commander, Lieutenant Colonel Patrick Pihana, managed to produce a bottle of whiskey and waited to have shots with Gabe and Carrie. Gabe did a single shot and went to bed exhausted. The next day, he recalled a conversation he'd had with Jason Cunningham in the week leading up to Take Her Gar. We were walking, bored one day, throwing rocks toward this minefield and joking about how maybe we could set one off, when the PJ mentioned, almost in passing, my daughter, 4-year-old Kyla, had a dream and told me, Daddy, Daddy, you're going to get shot and die. Even as Cunningham lay bleeding out and dying, Gabe recalls, I still believed he'd pull through. I'm a hopelessly optimistic guy. The entire experience, the mission, Jason's death, and his little girl's dream left Gabe feeling ready to go home and see my family. I'd had a part to play, did it well, could have done better, but I feel I was the right guy at the right time. I was glad I was there. It all goes back to how I grew up and became a part of this thing, CCT. Operation Anaconda was considered to be a failure by most measures. No fleeing masses of Al-Qaeda fighters were smashed by the hammer of Commander Zia's ATF against the 10th Mountain and 101st Airborne Anvil. For the men of AFO, though, it was a solid success. In the end, they were responsible for the majority of the killing. The Pentagon estimated the number of enemy killed was upwards of 800. This figure is almost certainly spurious. Based on captured documents, enemy intercepts, and physical evidence, a more likely figure is between 150 and 300. In General Trebon's estimation, the 13 men of Blaber's AFO were responsible for 60% of enemy casualties. But the TF-11 commander's estimation leaves out an important calculus. The vast majority of those enemy numbers can be attributed to five men. Jay Hill, Andy Martin, and once the battle for the summit of Take Her Gar is included, Jim Hotaling, Gabe Brown, and John Chapman. The travesty at the end of the operation is the loss of the seven men on Take Her Gar. Those deaths, SEAL Neil Roberts, CCT John Chapman, PJ Jason Cunningham, Air Crewman Phil Svitok, and the three Rangers, Mark Anderson, Bradley Crows, and Matthew Commons, do not lie at the feet of Delta's Pete Blaber and AFO, but the leaders of SEAL Team 6, specifically Joe Kernan and Tim Zemanski, and their rush to push men into the battle and take over operations from Blaber. But to Blaber, Vic, the SEAL officer in Gardez, abandoning the safe house without coordinating was tantamount to dereliction, and the confusion it caused on the mountain directly resulted in Jason Cunningham's death. But the losses to Al-Qaeda were also significant. There is strong evidence that al-Zawahiri, the number 2 AQ leader, was present in the valley, perhaps even wounded with a head injury, but escaped. Tohir Yuldashev, leader of the Islamic Movement of Uzbekistan, also escaped. One other was not so lucky, Saif or Rahman Mansur, the symbolic guidon-wielding fighter who led his men bravely from the front, was killed. Their failed last effort to stand ground and combat the Allied troops en masse did cause an exodus, though the Allied victory may have been pyrrhic. Many would return in future battles in both Afghanistan and Iraq. From the enemy. We begged our commander, Saif ur-Rahman Mansur, to allow the brothers to leave the valley. This was the way of the Mujahideen. Move away from an enemy that outnumbers and possesses superior weapons. We had no water. My mouth was bleeding, and the sores prevented me from eating my bread. All the Uzbeks were now martyred. The Afghans were all gone. Then I received word that our commander was martyred, and I began to cry. We tried to get to his body to carry him away, but the bombs were too many, and the enemy were now everywhere. I asked all our brothers to retreat, except the ones manning the PK machine gun and RPG-7 rocket launcher. Brother Abu Talib As-Saudi insisted upon staying, and said to me, "I feel ashamed in front of Allah to retreat from the Americans." Due to the heavy bombardment, a large portion of his head was missing, but he joined us as we began our retreat. The brothers all dispersed in different directions. I traveled with 10 Arab brothers. Due to the increased numbers of coalition forces blocking the area, as well as the aerial channels the enemy had, we were forced to travel for 3 days and nights in conditions that were extremely harsh. We had nothing to eat with us, except a case of green tea and a pot in which to boil snow. After this long journey, enduring the cold and the snow, and traveling over mountain peaks and through valleys, we finally reached a village where we received a great welcome, such that it made us forget all that we had suffered and endured, and all praise belongs to Allah alone. Mansur was killed by Jay Hill in a B-1 bomb strike. J-Team had watched the leader through their optics. Recalls Chris, he was short, 5'4 to 5'8, stocky strong, wore a medium-length beard, black hair, carried the banner flag when it was taken down, and gave hand and arm signals. Jay was finally handed a B-1 and ordered a bomb box with 6 J-dams set on airburst. The bombs scored 1 direct hit, 1 near direct hit. They watched the site for signs of follow-up activity, and the next day, 7 enemy in white turbans moved to the destroyed fighting positions and attempted to remove the leader from the wreckage. AFO had accomplished its mission better than anyone could have expected. For Blaber, it was validation of his method, his men, and their mission. Andy Martin and Mako 3-1 had slipped out, passing through friendly 10th Mountain Force lines and back to Gardez at the very time Chapman was fighting for his life. They woke the next morning to the news of Chapman's and Roberts's deaths. 2 days later, J-Team crept off the mountain to end its mission. Jay had called in his last airstrike only an hour or so before they mounted their trusty ATVs and started down the mountainside, now purged of Al-Qaeda. Along the way, the team paused to examine the cave complex they'd bombed the first morning, from which the Al-Qaeda fighters nearly ambushed them. They found 2 Soviet D-30 artillery pieces, a destroyed 37mm anti-aircraft gun, and fire pits inside the surrounding buildings, which were accented with planted trees and rock curbs along the road, signs of a senior AQ leader. In the buildings, they found discarded sleeping bags, fruit juice boxes with Arabic writing, and well-established fighting positions surrounding the compound. Tire tracks led away from the complex, heading east toward Pakistan. Having witnessed some of the near-fratricide incidents firsthand, they left in daylight so as to pass through the 101st lines before dark. Jay had secured a P-3 escort just in case. After dark and their safe passage through friendly lines, they were met by 2 MH-47s. The exhausted men sat silently on their ATVs, watching the helicopters as they made their way across the valley toward their extraction HLZ. The team loaded onto the helicopters, blades spinning, and were carried above the devastation they'd wrought throughout the valley. They could see the destruction on the features below as they passed on their way back to Gardez, the last of the original AFO teams. All of J-Team faced the risks and challenges of Blaber's AFO missions, but only one carried the burden of precision and no-fail aspects of the destruction of the enemy they faced. Jay Hill, the lone combat controller. For combat control, Anaconda exemplified the maturation of a nearly 40-year evolution beginning in the jungles of Laos. Without direction or pre-planning, individual controllers, some of whom didn't even know one another, established a self-organizing and directing network that destroyed the most organized and effective force Al-Qaeda and the Taliban would ever muster on a field of battle. In all, there were 14 CCT involved in the operation. Of the role of CCT in Anaconda and elsewhere, Jay Hill states, "We, combat controllers, were the most technically savvy guys out there. We pull our experience from the best in the world, Aussie SAS, British SBS, Delta, ST-6, all of them. Nobody else, nobody has that exposure and experience. None of the units we work with each other like that, aside from an occasional bilateral op operation. Sometimes when you raise your hand during operational briefings, younger SEALs or Delta operators roll their eyes. What's the Air Force guy got to say? But older guys know." Part 3. Aftermath. Chapter 24. March 5th. In Windsor Locks, Connecticut, Terry was in her kitchen pulling meat off a chicken carcass to make chicken soup. At 10:30 p.m., she heard a knock at the front door. No one ever went to the front door. Terry says, "If they knew us, they came to the back door." I went into the living room, flipped on the light, and opened the door. All I could say was, "No, not my Johnny. Not my Johnny." I let them in and yelled for my husband Nicholas as I sat on the couch, crying uncontrollably while they read their statement. Around 10:45, Nick called John's sister, Lori. Waking from a dead sleep, she immediately knew something was wrong. No one called her that late. She could hear Terry wailing in the background